Stand by for the fastest 60 minutes in Jewish radio. It's time for the Jewish Experience. Welcome back, and what a great treat we have in store for you this Erev Shabbos. Hi, I'm Hirsch Lynn, your host, and you are tuned in to Pittsburgh's only Jewish radio program, The Jewish Experience. And we are very fortunate to have on the program today Moshe Feiglin, who is the co-founder and leader of the largest voting faction in the Likud Party in Israel. He's become the spokesman for turning the state of the Jews into the Jewish state. Oops, make sure you stay with us on this one. We'll also have an update on the Iranian nuclear situation with Jeff Cohan of the United Jewish Federation. This adrenaline-pumping show is definitely going to give you some pause for thought as you head into Shabbos Vayera, which tells the story of how God reveals himself to our patriarch Abraham 3 days after his circumcision, or bris, at the age of 99. But Abraham leaves the presence of God. Can you imagine to take care of three guests who come to his tent in the desert? Well, these guests are actually malachim, or angels. And one of them tells Abraham that his wife Sarah is going to bear him a child in a year. And, of course, Sarah overhears and laughs, thinking that she's too old to have a child. Meanwhile, God decides to destroy the city of Sodom, and Abraham tries to stop him by pointing out, hey, there might be some righteous people there. Not able to find even a minion or ten of them, God proceeds to destroy the city. The other two angels that were guests left Abraham. They went to Sodom to rescue Lot, Abraham's nephew. And when fleeing from Sodom, Lot's wife looks at the city, even though she wasn't supposed to do that, and turns into a pillar of salt. Well, Lot's daughters are all he's got left, and they get their father drunk, and they lie with him, and the two nations of Moab and Ammon are born. Well, Sarah does conceive a son and calls him Yitzchak, or Isaac, meaning we'll laugh. Sarah sees Ishmael, Hagar's son, trying to hurt Yitzchak, and tells Abraham to send her and her son away. And of course, Abraham doesn't want to do it, because it is his kid, you know. But God says, listen to Sarah. And finally, Abraham gets his last test. God asks him to sacrifice his son, which he's willing immediately to do. But the angel comes the last minute to tell Abraham he passed the test and he doesn't need to do it. And, of course, they find a ram and they take care of it that way. So, speaking of sacrifice, our staff has sacrificed themselves to bring you the quality Jewish radio. With Musical Moish, Rabbi Meir Goldwasser, Rabbi Yosef Eisen, and Miss Devorah DeLynn. So sit back and enjoy 60 minutes of the best Jewish radio in Pennsylvania. Of course, we'll have your community announcements and mazel tovs along with current news fresh from Israel National Radio coming up on the half hour. And if you haven't sponsored a segment yet, it's time to get off your tuchas and do it right now. We want to continue to bring you the best and only authentic Jewish radio in Pittsburgh, but we have to have your support. And if you want to continue to hear us on the air, you really got to get up and do it. Everybody has to help just a little. Nobody has to help a lot. You can call us and get the mitzvah today at 412-979-5770 or jewishexperience@verizon.net. You can sponsor your favorite segment. You've got a great choice. You got Rabbi Goldwasser's Torah lesson. Popular story segment, community news and announcements, popular feminine perspective, Rabbi Eisen's moment in Jewish history. So call right now and reserve your spot. As always, we thank our regular sponsors, Burton Hirsch Funeral Home, Next Generation Financial Services, First Mariner Bank, Pittsburgh Simcha Orchestra, led by our own Musical Moishe, and Artistic Photography. Don't forget to ask for a special gift of a beautiful refrigerator magnet that is yours free when you call us at 412-979-5770, or if you send us an email at jewishexperience@verizon.net. Now, we got candlelighting time tonight is 6.07 p.m.
Mitzmah, Lumia, Mina, Israel, Shalom.
Now with an insight on this week's Parsha is our resident rabbi, Rabbi Meir Goldwasser.
The 10th and final test in which Hashem asked Avraham to sacrifice his own son is considered a pillar of merit for the Jewish people before Hashem. Therefore, we mention it in our prayers every day. We ask Hashem to remember us for good and the merit of our forefather Avraham. There is a question about this that is well known. Why do we more often mention that Avraham went to sacrifice his son than we refer to the countless other holy people, such as Rabbi Akiva and his pious colleagues, who actually gave up their own lives to sanctify Hashem's name? In fact, Avraham had actually heard the request directly from Hashem, whereas all of the other holy martyrs who gave up their lives to sanctify Hashem's name did so even without hearing Hashem speak to them. This would appear to give them more merit. Chassidus explains that Avraham's unique merit lies in the fact that he was the first individual to serve Hashem to the point of self-sacrifice. Initiating something new is very hard. According to the axiom, all beginnings are difficult. Once Avraham opened up this way of serving Hashem, he was able to draw down to his descendants, all of the Jewish people, the strength and ability to follow in his footsteps. It is much easier for us to serve Hashem with self-sacrifice, since the power to do so has already been given us through Avraham. The only thing that is required of us is to bring this power from its potential to an actual deed. Avraham acted out of awe and love of Hashem. Hashem said to go, and Avraham went. He did not do this to show the world how deep one's submission to Hashem must be, since no one else was present when Avraham bound his son on the altar. Actually, sacrificing his son would have been incompatible with spreading godliness in the world. If anyone would have heard about it, the basic belief that Avraham had taught the people would have been uprooted, and spreading godliness would have been discontinued. The concept underlining the self-sacrifice Avraham displayed is that Hashem desired and requested, and Avraham eagerly obeyed. The uniqueness and special quality of Avraham's willingness to sacrifice his son is that it was not at all based on reasoning. Avraham completely gave himself over to Hashem. He nullified himself to the point of not considering himself or his desires. Hashem's will was his will. The Alter Rebbe writes that it is beneficial to recite every day the Torah chapter recounting Avraham's willingness to sacrifice his son. This teaches us to subjugate our personal desires in order to serve Hashem on the level of self-sacrifice manifested by Yitzchak in his willingness to give up his life. Yet, how can we compare our service, consisting of subjugating our desires to Hashem, to that of Yitzchak, who was prepared to be sacrificed for the purest of motives, with no other considerations? The comparison is possible because Avraham opened the channel of self-sacrifice. When Avraham led his son to the altar and bequeathed to him the strength and discipline to sacrifice his life, he bequeathed this same power of complete self-sacrifice to us. As Jews, our true essence consists of our total dedication to serving Hashem. With every service we now render to Hashem, we subjugate our desire and will to Him, just as Yitzchak was willing to give up his life. It is as though Avraham is leading us, all his children, to the altar, because our true essence is to give ourselves totally over to Hashem.
Retirement can be a wonderful reward for years of hard work, but it can also be stressful as you deal with questions about how to maintain your standard of living while protecting what you worked so hard for. What if I told you that you could generate extra cash flow without touching a penny of your savings, investments, or current income? If you or someone you love is 62 years or older and owns their own home, they may be able to take advantage of a federally regulated program called a home equity conversion mortgage or reverse mortgage. Seniors all across the U.S. are using reverse mortgages to increase their cash flow for purchasing long-term care insurance, putting grandkids through college, making charitable donations, paying off credit card debt, paying for prescription drugs, buying vacation homes, and paying for much-needed home repair. Call for a free copy of the Homekeeper Mortgage Consumer Fact Sheet today. Get the facts and help yourself and your family through a reverse mortgage. Call Andy at 412-562-2220 for a free copy while supplies last. Again, that number is 412-562-2220 for your free copy of the Homekeeper Mortgage Consumer Fact Sheet. First Mariner Bank is an equal housing lender.
Will Israel ever see an end to violence? How will the war against Iraq's insurgents impact Israel? Will changes on the Supreme Court have any effect on the Jewish community? Is anti-Semitism in Europe on the rise? What can be done about it? For a look behind the headlines, read the Forward, the nation's Jewish newspaper. The Forward reveals the personalities, motivations, and histories that are fueling the news abroad. The Forward also provides an in-depth look at issues affecting us at home, with comprehensive reports on everything from politics and religion to culture and the arts. It even has its own matchmaking section for Jewish singles. Try 4 weeks free, then be billed $24.95 for another 26 issues. Not satisfied? Just write cancel on the bill and keep the first four issues free.
Call now for The Forward, 800-992-3333. That's 800-992-3333. All around us, life is moving faster and faster. Things are changing all the time, and it's a comfort to know in your time of need that at Burton Hirsch Funeral Home, the Jewish tradition continues. Burton Hirsch Funeral Home has served the Pittsburgh Jewish community since 1947 and has recently remodeled its entire facility to better serve you. Burton Hirsch Funeral Directors are members of the Jewish Funeral Directors Association and work closely with area rabbis to ensure that your needs as a Jewish family are totally met. Their attentive and compassionate guidance results in treating each family as their own. I personally met with Michael Hilgefort. And did you know that Burton Hirsch Funeral Home is even involved with community educational programs to ensure that Jewish families know what to do to have a proper burial? In your time of special need, call Squirrel Hill's only Jewish funeral home, Burton Hirsch, at 412-521-2600. That's 412-521-2600. They welcome your request to visit and tour their state-of-the-art facilities. Burton Hirsch Funeral Home, proud sponsors of the Jewish Experience, 412-521-2600. And with Rabbi Eisen on vacation this week, once again sitting in for him is Dr. Michael Shulman, director of AskNoah.org, with a history of Noahides around the Roman Empire time. Now here's Dr. Shulman.
The obligation of Gentiles to observe the details of the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach, the seven Noahide commandments, and the praises of righteous Gentiles who connected in this way with God's will, have been part of the written and oral Torah since the revelation at Mount Sinai. The Torah also includes the institution of the Ger Toshav. These were observant Noahides who lived as legally protected citizens in the Holy Land. The condition was the same as for the observance of the 50-year cycle of Yovel, or Jubilee years, which required that the 12 Jewish tribes were settled in their assigned areas. Historically, it is known that there were large numbers of non-Jews in the Roman Empire who lived as righteous Gentiles, up until they were repressed by the idolatrous government after the destruction of the Second Temple. The Talmud and Midrash used the term Yirei Shemayim, or heaven fears, for these righteous Gentiles. These Jewish sources focus on describing their great spiritual merit, and some noteworthy Roman individuals who followed this path are mentioned. The Midrash Genesis Rabbah states that some of the cities around the Mediterranean Sea were judged by the heavenly court to be deserving of extermination, but they were saved by the merit of producing even just one heaven-fearing Gentile per year. It is virtually impossible to find any unbiased historical mention of this subject outside of the Talmud and Midrash, because these God-fearing Gentiles became the prime targets for the missionizing activities of Paul and his followers, and they are almost always referred to in that slanted context. The best objective historical sources are in the writings of Josephus. In the Antiquities of the Jews, Book 14, paragraph 110, Josephus writes, quote, There were four classes of men among those of Cyrene, that of citizens, that of husbandmen, the third of strangers, and the fourth of Jews. Now these Jews have already gotten into all cities, and it is hard to find a place in the habitable earth that has not admitted this tribe of men, and is not possessed by them. And it has come to pass that Egypt and Cyrene, and a great number of other nations, imitate their way of living, and maintain great bodies of these Jews in a peculiar manner, and grow up to a greater prosperity with them, and make use of the same laws with that nation also. Unquote. After the destruction of the Second Temple, the persecutions of repression and missionizing quickly took their toll, along with the absence of the Temple, which had been the centers of spiritual and moral guidance for the heaven-fearers. Clearly, the past persecutions of both the heaven-fearers and the Jews no longer apply in most countries around the world today, and this has been conducive to the development of the modern Noahide movement. For approximately the past three decades, the world has undergone a fascinating revolution. There has been an ever-growing interest in the Torah's Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach, the seven Noahide commandments. A great number of Gentiles throughout the world have already committed themselves to observe the universal Noahide code. To facilitate this movement, the website AskNoah.org was founded right here in Pittsburgh, followed by the founding of the outreach organization Ask Noah International and the United Noahide Academies Project for Noahide Education. We invite you to visit our website, where you'll find history in the making.
Now, from the Israel National Radio Newsroom, here's Ernie Singer.
United States Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is scheduled to return to Jerusalem and Ramallah November 4th to the 6th to follow up on her recent discussions with Israeli and PLO leaders on what the State Department website calls the need for progress on Phase 1 commitments under the roadmap, both to improve conditions on the ground and to build confidence between the parties. Confidence lacking right now because the PLO has not met demands to improve security, although the PLO says it has done so by reorganizing its leadership and government. Foreign Minister Tzipi Livni says the PLO must do more to curb terror before Israel acts on the Arab demand to curtail growth in Jewish communities beyond the 1949 ceasefire lines. An example of PLO shortcomings, Arabs putting fire to the synagogue at Yad Ya'ir near the Sumerian Jewish community of Dolev, west of Ramallah, for the second time in 6 months. Congregants who arrived at the synagogue for prayers Friday morning found it going up in flames, consuming Torah scrolls, Torah books, and other holy books. The Arabs also defaced the memorial to terror victim Yair Mendelsohn located next to the synagogue. They destroyed a playground for children and placed a torn Israeli flag under some rocks on the approach road. Friday marking the first time Livni is joining Prime Minister Ehud Olmert in meeting with PLO Chairman Mahmoud Abbas. Olmert briefing U.S. National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley this past week about his meetings at the start of the week with French, British, and Turkish leaders. Secretary Rice in Turkey to attend a ministerial meeting on Iraq and to hold bilateral talks with Turkish leaders just before she comes to Israel. She has told the House Foreign Affairs Committee why the Middle East conference in America a month or so from now must show results.
Without a serious political prospect for the Palestinians, that gives to moderate leaders a horizon that they can show to their people that indeed there is a two-state solution that is possible, we will lose the window for a two-state solution, that you will see the further radicalization of Palestinian politics, of politics in the region. We will be pressing very hard for our allies to help in this endeavor, because it will benefit, of course, the responsible Arab states if this conference is a success. They too face the same forces of extremism that are making it difficult in the Palestinian territories.
Dr. Rice putting Iran's Revolutionary Guard and three of the Islamic Republic state-owned banks on the terror list this week. At a State Department media briefing, the secretary saying,
"We and our partners remain fully committed to a diplomatic solution with Iran. On our behalf, the EU's Javier Solana reaffirmed that offer to Iran this week. Unfortunately, the Iranian government continues to spurn our offer of open negotiations, instead threatening peace and security by pursuing nuclear technologies that can lead to a nuclear weapon, building dangerous ballistic missiles, supporting Shia militants in Iraq and terrorists in Iraq, Afghanistan, Lebanon, and the Palestinian territories, and denying the existence of a fellow member of the United Nations, threatening to wipe Israel off the map."
U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. Iran's foreign minister telling Kuwait's Mishkat Arai that his country does not know where missing Israeli Air Force navigator Ron Arad is located. National Religious Party Chairman Zvulun Orlev says that the NRP will put forth a no-confidence motion following the interview given by Minister Ghaleb Mejadeh to Arai Israel's first Muslim Arab minister says he does not rule out the possibility that Jewish communities in Judea and Samaria might meet the fate of those in Gaza and northern Samaria, which were uprooted in 2005. Majadli also telling the newspaper that Israel is willing to pay the price of returning the Golan Heights to Syria for peace. This past week marked the anniversaries of the deaths of biblical matriarch Rachel and Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. A number of shows take a look at these events on demand on the Internet at IsraelNationalRadio.com. Shabbat is Tet Vav, the 15th of Cheshvan on the Jewish calendar, and the weather forecast: continued clear to partly cloudy and cooler on Friday. No significant change in temperature on Shabbat. Slightly cooler Sunday and Monday. In Jerusalem on Friday, a high temperature of 24 degrees centigrade, 75 Fahrenheit. Ernie Singer, Israel National Radio.
That was a look at Jerusalem weather. And now for your local weather, here's meteorologist Glenn Foxen.
Mostly cloudy with cool weather and occasional showers are in store for Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on Shabbos. Improving weather conditions are predicted early next week after the passage of a cold front and a high-pressure system moves in. So in a nutshell, a low-pressure system over Mississippi will spread showers into southwest Pennsylvania during the day on Shabbos. After the low passes and moves north of Pennsylvania on Saturday night, we will see clearing skies with cooler and drier weather on Sunday and Monday. Daytime high temperatures around 60 degrees, and nighttime low temperatures around 40 degrees. In the long term, dry weather is expected through most of next week. Also, a piece of information, with November just around the corner, the average amount of snow in November for the Pittsburgh area is 0.5 inches. Wishing everyone good weather and a great Shabbos. This has been meteorologist Glenn Foxen with your Shabbos weather.
Okay, we're very excited to have Jeff Cohan with us, who is the Director of Community and Public Affairs for the United Jewish Federation and currently involved with the Iran Task Force. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Irish.
Okay, and I appreciate you taking time out to be with us. The concern now is with Iran and its struggle to get a nuclear weapon. Is it first of all, a lot of people think, what's the big deal? This is a country; it's sovereign; it has a right to defend itself if it wants to have a nuclear weapon. If it wants, what's so different in this case than it is with any other country?
Well, for one thing, we should be very concerned about any country that doesn't currently have nuclear weapons acquiring nuclear weapons. Because nuclear proliferation, in general, is undoubtedly the greatest threat to humanity.
Mm-hmm.
Would even put it ahead of global warming, if you can imagine that.
Well, what about the country that says, hey, you know, these other countries have nuclear weapons, and we feel like if we don't have them, that we're going to be subject to their whim?
Well, certainly nobody is threatening to use nuclear weapons against Iran. And Iran is certainly endowed to have a peaceful nuclear energy program under international regulations, but is not entitled to a nuclear weapons program and has no need for a nuclear weapons program except for offensive purposes.
Okay, of course, the concept of Ahmadinejad coming out and threatening Israel, of course, will probably make the fact that he'll follow through on that threat if he has the capabilities to do so.
Right, and that's what makes this particularly scary. During the Cold War, there was the concept of mutually assured deterrence, and there was some sense that neither the United States nor the Soviet Union would fire nuclear weapons at each other because of the danger that each side could annihilate the other. In the case of Iran, however, it doesn't appear Ahmadinejad would be deterred by Israel, even if Israel does have nuclear weapons, which we don't know for sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, the key here, though, is, and I don't know if we know any of this on the ground, but what's going on internally in Iran right now? The average person on the street has to know that if Ahmadinejad decides to make a move, that there will be a huge parking lot that used to be called Iran. I mean, everything will be destroyed.
Well, it's complicated, and we're going to learn a lot about that on Tuesday, December 11th, when Patrick Clausen, one of the country's foremost Iran experts, comes to Pittsburgh for a free lecture
mm-hmm.
at the Carnegie Library Lecture Hall. It's a complicated question, and there are certainly those within the Iranian power structure, even who are not comfortable with the way Ahmadinejad is managing this issue.
Sure, and in fact, I would say that we hear both sides. We hear sometimes he's got the internal backing and sometimes he doesn't. But they have to know. I mean, Iran is not excluded from the world community. That should they make one move, I mean, they're going to be history. A good example, and I'd like you to comment on this, is Israel's strike into Syria. Now, Israel obviously didn't wait for the U.S. Or anybody. They saw something going on there, and of course we don't know, we're only what we see. And they decided to take proactive action, and they did what they had to do, and obviously it was such a clean situation that even Syria didn't make a move to say anything until, weeks or months after. So the same thing would probably happen to Iran. The problem is that they have multiple sites and have multiple activities going on at the same time. So what's an effective course of action then in keeping Iran throttled, so to speak, and preventing them from getting to the end point?
Well, the Iran Task Force at Pittsburgh, which I need to emphasize, is an interfaith, nonpartisan coalition that's made up of numerous organizations and elected officials at the state and federal level. This task force definitely subscribes to the belief, as does the Israeli government, that vigorous economic and diplomatic sanctions are necessary to avert the need for military action against Iran.
Do you think that really is effective?
I really do. In fact, we see it having some effect already, and I think one of the reasons Ahmadinejad is encountering some resistance from some of the other ruling elites in Iran is precisely because they are feeling the economic pinch and diplomatic isolation.
Yeah, I wonder about that. I mean, we've tried that with Saddam Hussein, and it enabled him to get all his WMDs out of the country and also to do a lot of preparatory action while we were sitting and waiting, you know, to do something. And certainly his people were suffering, but, of course, he wasn't suffering. It's a little bit different in Iran in the sense that Ahmadinejad is a dictator, but he's under the whim of his ruling elite. He's not the top guy, so that may make it a little bit different. But even so, I'd like to see economic sanctions work, but somehow these guys figure out a way to get around it.
I mean, they may find a way to mitigate the effects of the economic sanctions, but they're already having some effect. And we can only hope that we're just at the beginning of the road that needs to be taken to really put economic and diplomatic pressure on Iran.
What's your sense or take on where the Bush administration is on this? Are they itching at the trigger here, or how are they looking at it?
No, I think based on the experience that the Bush administration has had in Iraq, that the Bush administration sort of like Iran doesn't necessarily speak with one voice either.
Mm-hmm.
But I doubt that President Bush is in any hurry to engage in military activity against Iran. And I think if he was in a hurry, he would have done it already.
Right.
And I give the Bush administration a lot of credit for, you know, working hard with our allies in Europe and with Russia and China and the other members of the Security Council to indeed impose economic sanctions on Iran.
You know, the Pittsburgh ZOA district has come out with an alert today, I think it was, urging people to take action to call Condoleezza Rice and other administration members to same concern you have. Are they part of your coalition?
Yes, they are.
Okay. Can you tell us how many different organizations are involved here?
Right now, I'd say roughly 11 different organizations and three state legislators and all three of our Congress members from this region.
Okay, and so the average person listening to this obviously is concerned about what Iran is going to do, and they want to know what they can do. So in a nutshell, besides attending this thing and learning about it, is there any other action steps that you recommend that these people can take at this time?
Well, there's two main things, one political and one personal.
Mm-hmm.
The political thing is to really support the politicians who are working to pass divestment legislation in Pennsylvania. What I'm talking about here is Pennsylvania, through its employee retirement systems, has money indirectly invested in Iran's energy sector.
Okay.
Not through American companies, but through mutual funds that are made up of foreign stocks.
Mm-hmm.
And there was legislation in the Pennsylvania legislature to divest from Iran. And actually, it's very overdue because the states of Florida and California and several other states have already passed divestment legislation. In Pennsylvania, as it is on many other issues, it was a little late to the party.
Okay. All right. Well, for our internet-savvy listeners, before we run out of time here, if people want to learn more about this now, where can they go?
I would recommend they go to this website, ujfpittsburgh.org/Iran. I'll just repeat that one more time, ujfpittsburgh.org/Iran. At their website, they'll find information about this December 11th event. And the website is continuously updated and includes links to other Iran-related websites that are continuously updated. So, excellent site to bookmark to keep yourself up to date on what's happening vis-a-vis Iran.
Okay, now these 11 organizations that are coalition here, that's in Pittsburgh. Is this group that's doing this task force here allied and working with and in coordination with other UJFs, so to speak, around the country on the same issue?
To some degree, yes. The Jewish Council for Public Affairs, which is itself a coalition made up of several national Jewish organizations, has adopted a resolution calling for Iran divestment and is active on this issue. So we do work in coordination with them.
Okay, good.
Jewish Council for Public Affairs.
So is this guy, Patrick Claussen, also going to these other groups and speaking all over the country, or you just happen to get him for this particular...
Well, some of your listeners might recognize Patrick Claussen's name. He's published frequently in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post. He does quite a bit of public speaking. He's an excellent public speaker, and we're very fortunate to secure his services and to bring him to Pittsburgh.
Great, great. Well, we are out of time, and Jeff, we appreciate you taking the time to be with us today on the Jewish Experience Radio program and to bring us up to date on the Iran Task Force of the United Jewish Federation, and hopefully we'll bear some fruit here. And I just want to remind everybody, Tuesday night, December 11th, Carnegie Library Lecture Hall for Patrick Claussen, and it's a free lecture, and it's something where we welcome Jews and non-Jews, obviously, because it's a serious threat, not just to the balance of power in the Middle East, but it's coming our way. If it starts there, I guarantee you, we're going to be right there. Isn't that true?
Yes, and Ursh, I just have to remind people that, you know, whether this is 1938 or not, it's difficult to say at this point, but we don't have the luxury of pretending it's not 1938. We have to assume it is, and we can't afford to repeat the mistakes that were made in the 1930s with regard to Nazi Germany. We have a chance to get it right this time.
Yeah.
And galvanizing the Jewish community on Tuesday, December 11th, is the first step in that direction.
Excellent. Thank you again. Jeff Cohen, Director of Community and Public Affairs, United Jewish Federation in Pittsburgh, and spokesman for the Iran Task Force. Thank you for being with us.
Okay. Thank you, Arsh.
Take care. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
We want to wish our brothers and sisters in the Holy Land a very peaceful and restful Shabbat.
And the Mazel Tovs this week, the Upshurnish of Mendel Stein, son of Rabbi Yossi and Chanelis Stein, means he turns 3 years old, gets his first haircut. And Rabbi and Mrs. Shimon Baruch Weiss on the bar mitzvah of their son, Mendy. And boys, mark your calendars. The Father and Son program at the Kollel will be starting again November 10th at 7:15 p.m. More details are going to follow in the coming weeks. You want to get some more information right now? Call the Kollel for more information at 412-420-0220. And Dr. Alex Grobman will be speaking on Thursday, November 8th at the JCC Levinson Hall at 7 p.m. He's going to speak on Lessons from Kristallnacht, International Anti-Semitism. And he's just finished a book called Nations United, about the United Nations' anti-Zionistic position. For more information, contact Miss Edie Neve at 412-421-1500. Now, we got the meeting of Food Addicts in Recovery Anonymous meets at Shari Tower every Sunday evening from 7 to 8:30 p.m. The program is a recovery group for people who cannot control their eating and or their weight. It's not for women only. Men are invited. For more information, call Ilana at 412-422-2224. And if you'd like to have your Mazel Tovs on our program, just make sure you get them in on time. Call 412-979-5770 or email jewishexperiencesofverizon.net by noon on Tuesday for that week's program. Don't forget, candlelighting time this week is 6:07 p.m. So a great pleasure this afternoon on the Jewish Experience Radio program to have with us Moshe Feiglin, who is the co-founder of Manhigut Yehudit, the Jewish leadership movement in Israel, and also the leader of the largest faction in the Likud party. Moshe, welcome to the program.
Good evening.
Thank you for being with us. The reason we've had you on the and asked you to come on the program today is because there is talk and a lot of information flying about the prospects of giving up the sacred city of Yerushalayim, of Jerusalem, in upcoming talks with Prime Minister Olmert and the Bush administration, as well as the Palestinian Authority. You have been involved in this, as well as some others. The first question I have for you is, how realistic is this breakup? Do you see it actually coming? And what is Many Good Yehudi doing to hopefully stop it from happening?
Look, on one hand, it looks like it's not going to be simple at all for Olmert to do that. There's a lot of people and also politicians, Knesset members, Likud members who oppose it and hopefully will vote against it.
Okay.
However, we have a very bad experience with Ariel Sharon and other leaders that at the beginning no one believed that they're going to really do what they said they're going to do, and at the end they did it.
Yes.
So we have to consider all the time the worst possibility and get prepared to it and fight against it. Now, Manigut Yehudit is gathering together a lot of pressure, positive pressure, against Olmert, and it brings results already.
Mm-hmm.
61 Knesset members already signed up that they're not going to vote for it.
Okay.
We started to arrange the Central Committee of Likud to get a decision that any future government led by Likud will not fulfill the results of this negotiation. And this way, we're putting pressure and taking the wind or pulling the rug under this negotiation of Yerushalayim.
On this issue, is Netanyahu with you on this? Is he working with you on this particular issue? I know you're at odds on many things, but on this particular issue, are you together on this?
Look, Netanyahu declared all the time that he's against the separation of Yerushalayim,
mm-hmm.
and the fact that this pressure starts from the grassroots of the party definitely encourage him to do the same.
Okay. So, and the next question comes from the concept of the prime minister, who is under indictment, as far as I know, from four different sources, having any kind of standing whatsoever to be able to even propose this kind of thing. Where does he get that kind of power in the Israeli government makeup? And the Knesset has to back him on this. So he seems like he's unilaterally going out there and making all kinds of promises. And how does he? Where does he get the authority to do that?
From the media.
Uh-huh.
From the justice system. From the extreme left who control the country. And that's it. It is not from the people. It is not from the so-called democracy.
Where is the majority of Israelis on the issue of the division of Yerushalayim?
The majority of the Israelis are definitely against any division of Yerushalayim. However, the majority of Israel don't count. When in Israel, when you vote for the left, you get left, and when you vote for the right,
you get left.
Of course, you get even extra left. So people understood that their vote don't really count. It's a summer zero game, unless they will come to understand and have a real feeling that there's a real alternative, they'll remain irrelevant, and leaders will continue to do whatever they want against the will of the people.
So with that kind of attitude, I mean, your goal is to turn the state of the Jews into the Jewish state, and you've been working very hard on this over a number of years with, obviously, many others. and trying to build this kind of coalition. But with that kind of attitude, where the people are at the point where, you know, many of them, obviously, I guess, don't care and maybe don't even pay attention, which is amazing, being in that kind of a spot where their very lives depend on it. Yet you are making some gains. I mean, in the last election, you picked up a quarter of the vote in the Likud, and obviously see yourself moving ahead. What is your strategy for motivating and energizing the so to speak, the grassroots to be able to lift Manny Good Yehudit into the leadership position of Likud and eventually the prime minister leadership of the state of Israel?
Look, we need to get to the Likud members, that there are about 100,000 people, and convince them and explain to them that if they want to leave their kids, if they want to see their kids and their grandkids and grandchildren living in a Jewish state, they need to have Jewish leadership. Because only leaders that believe in the people, that believe in the country, that believe in God, in the God of Israel, can deal with a challenge that these days, that Israel have these days in front of. When you don't have these basic beliefs, you can't even explain your own children why to stay, to remain staying in Israel. And as we know, Olmert's kid lives in New York.
Right.
And if you can't explain this basic things to your own kids, how can you lead the nation? How can you lead the, how can you explain the citizens why to stay in Israel?
Exactly.
This is the kind of leadership that Israel needs to simply to survive. And people understand that when you're explaining it to them. And you just need to get to them. And that's a lot of work. And that's what we do.
Okay. One of the members of the Knesset, Benny Alon, used to be with you guys, Zohar Tzenu, and he kind of gone off doing his own thing, introduced an initiative to transfer some Arabs, dismantle the Palestinian Authority, and give the Arabs their Jordanian citizenship. Do you support his plan? Do you think that has any chance of succeeding?
Look, my opinion on Benny Lone's plan is irrelevant. You should ask the Jordanian and the Egyptian about his plan, because he needs them to agree to his plan. So,
okay.
So, I'm not the person to ask.
Okay, fine. Well, the last question I have for you is this, and this is what we hear as we talk about Manny Good Yehudit, and that is that the Likud is always touted as the leadership party. Many people feel that if Manny Good Yehudit does take over the Likud, that because of its focus, will make it a very narrow party and therefore will lose its leadership position. How do you respond to that?
I think it's exactly the other way around. The political history of Israel shows that every time that Likud stood for the basic values of a national camp, it won big time. And every time it decided to be centralist and give up on its values, on the national values, it lost. Today, people cannot say the difference between Likud and Kadima and Labor. Cannot say the difference between Netanyahu and Ehud Barak. And therefore, people don't see the Likud as an alternative anymore.
Yeah, it's
when
very...
Likud will come back to its principles, when people will know exactly what the difference is, they'll understand that there is an alternative, and there is something to look for, and the Likud will go back to his... the days of 48 mandates and even up. That's the truth. It's exactly the opposite. When I will lead Likud Be'ezrat Hashem, Likud will win big time.
Well, look forward to it. So if our listeners today are asking and they're listening and they're saying, well, this sounds great, but what can we do to help? What do you recommend on the U.S.
join,
side?
Join Manny Good Yehudit. Get it to our website, jewishisrael.org. It's jewishisrael.org, and you can, through our website, get all the aisles to join Manny Good, to help Manny Good, to be involved, to be part of this unbelievable revolution, I may say, that we represent, and Be'ezrat Hashem, give us a hope that Israel will flourish and be a light among the nations, and Jews all around the world will not find, will not understand anymore what they're doing in the diaspora, and we want to join forces and come to Israel. We want our kids to be proud of the country. We want our kids to know about their heritage. We want a state that really represents the Jewish people and the Jewish history of over 3,000 years, and not just the last 60 years of the state of Israel. This is the kind of state we need, and this is the only way we're going to survive and flourish.
Excellent. Well, that's a great way to end it. We are out of time. I do appreciate you taking time out. I know you've been on a very tight schedule here in the U.S. On a tour, and wish you great success and much hatzlacha, and we look forward to speaking with you again. And as Moshe Feigel, he's co-founder of Manigut Yehudit, the Jewish leadership movement in Israel, and leader of the largest faction in the Likud party. Thank you very much for being with us. Have a great job.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye. Bye-bye. Now for a look at the feminine side of things, reporting from Israel, here's Ms. Devorah Delin.
Last week, we discussed different types of relationships a person can form between himself and his surroundings. We found that a person's strongest bond is formed between himself and his essence, between his intellect and his soul, which is, as the Tanya writes, a chelek eloka mimal mamish, a piece of Hashem himself. Interestingly, the Torah often speaks about relationships, because, as the Rambam says, man was not created to live alone. In this week's Torah portion, Parshas Vayera, the story opens up with Hashem appearing to Abraham on a third day after his bris milah. Abraham, whose strongest trait was midah of chesed, kindness, was waiting outside his tent under the boiling desert sun, gazing into the far distance to find anyone he could invite into his tent. The Midrash says that Hashem unveiled the light of the Tzaddikim, the super intense light that was hidden away from the mundane world at the time of creation, and that was what was making the day so hot. When the three angels, disguised as men, pass by, Abraham rushes to invite them in, and he serves them a royal feast. The Torah only describes the barest essentials of the feast he prepared, but it is from this meal that we learn the true beauty of giving a korban. The first thing Abraham asks for is me'at mayim, a little bit of water. This hints to the nesach hamayim, the offering of water that was done in the temple during the holiday of Sukkot. The next thing we learn about is a pas lechem, the loaves of bread. The Vilna Gaon says that this refers to either the mincha offering, which was made from grain, or it refers to the animal sacrifices, because basar, flesh, is referred to as bread in some cases. Perhaps because it, too, is a food staple for many people. The angels are then given water to wash their feet with, for fear that they were idol worshippers and served the ground they walked on. The Gaon says that they took this water and drank from it. This water was created during the 6 days of creation, and it hints to the Amudei Sheish, the pillars that stood in the Beis HaMikdash, from the word Sheish, which also means six. Finally, the angels are invited to sit under a tree. The tree hints to the Eitz Chaim, the tree of life. The three Avos, our patriarchs, are connected to the tree because they are the conduits through which the life-sustaining Shekhinah flows. The true beauty of the karban, the sacrifice, can be found in the root of the word karban, which is karov, to come close. As we see from the story above, what Abraham Avinu did through killing three cows and partaking in mundane food was that he brought himself and his visitors close to each other. He created a sense of friendship. Even when he thought his visitors were simple idol worshippers, he saw only their intrinsic value, that of the creation of Hashem, and he loved them and respected them just for that. When the angels are invited to partake of the food, the pasuk says, "Usadu levavchem," and satisfy your heart. Torah, the ultimate sustenance, has the power to negate the Yetzer Hara. It opens the heart and reveals the true chesed that lies within. Have a good Shabbos.
Now it's time for another classic story from our master storyteller, Rabbi Meir Goldwasser.
David HaMelech wrote in Tehillim, Ashrei Maskil Eldol. Praiseworthy is he who cares wisely for the impoverished. All of us are interested in doing favors for others, for this is our very nature. Yet many times, in our zealousness to do a favor, we fail to take into consideration the feelings of its recipient. It is indeed possible, for example, that a sick person may not want visitors. Then not to go to see him would be doing him a favor. It is possible that a dear friend might need a loan, but for him to know that we are aware of his dire financial straits might be humiliating to him. In such a case, arranging for him to get the money he needs through a third party would be appropriate. An example of this occurred a while back in Yerushalayim, involving a noted Sephardic Torah scholar and Kabbalah teacher. It happened that one of the prominent Rabbonim of Yerushalayim fell ill and was bedridden for months on end. He could no longer go to shul nor make any public appearances. After a while, the great Chacham of the city began to visit the Rav every Friday night on his way home from shul. He would spend quite a bit of time with the Rav, discussing the pressing issues of the day and seeking his counsel on problems he had faced throughout the week. After a number of weeks during which he made these Friday night visits, some of his family members asked him, "Why do you go and visit the Rav on Friday nights? Your family is kept waiting for you. The Rav you visit is bedridden at home, and is there every day and every night of the week. Why not visit him in the middle of the week?" The Chacham replied, "I am sure that on Friday night, the Rav remembers his days of glory. In years gone by, every Friday night, this Rav would make his way home from shul, accompanied by many of his congregants. He would tell them the words of Torah he had thought of during the week, and would discuss the various questions of Jewish law about which he had been consulted. Now, as an invalid, he has none of that honor. Friday night must be the saddest time of the week for him. For what he had, he no longer has. It is for that reason that I go to cheer him up specifically at that time. Even though some of my family members may be somewhat inconvenienced, this is a price worth paying in order that this great Talmud Chacham should not experience any anguish on the night of the Holy Shabbos." This is Rabbi Meir Goldwasser wishing you all a good Shabbos.
And as we come to the close of yet another exciting, action-packed edition of the Jewish Experience radio program, a couple of reminders, the Father and Son Learning Program at the Carlo, November 10th at 7:15 p.m., call 412-420-0220 for more information on that. Dr. Alex Grobman is going to be speaking on Lessons from Kristallnacht, International Anti-Semitism. That'll be at November 8th at the JCC Levinson Hall. Call Edie Neve for more information, 412-421-1500. Meeting of Food Addicts and Recovery Anonymous, Shari Torah, every Sunday evening, 7 to 8:30 p.m. Call Ilana, 412-422-2224, for more information on that. And also, if you'd like to have your Mazel Tovs on our program, you can call us at 412-979-5770 or email jewishexperience@verizon.net by noon on Tuesday for that week's program. And we certainly want to thank Moshe Feiglin, co-founder of Manigud Yehudit, the Jewish leadership movement in Israel, trying to turn the state of the Jews into the Jewish state. And to Jeff Cohen of the United Jewish Federation for his updates on the Iranian nuclear situation. And, of course, once again, our faithful and cutting-edge staff, Rabbi Meir Goldwasser, Rabbi Yosef Eisen, MusicalMoish.com, Dr. Michael Shulman, Ms. Devorah DeLynn, reporting, of course, from Israel, and our engineer, Jeremy Bossenstein, for another outstanding show. And don't forget, Candlelighting time is 6:07 p.m. It's been a ton of fun, and it is time to run. See you all next week. Same Yiddish time, same Yiddish channel.
Shabbat Shalom.